Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week, we're putting our thinking caps on as we ponder the essay. It's a format that prompts a mixed response. While some marvel at the endless possibilities for bright ideas and thoughtful prose, for others, it's a style of writing that brings back memories of homework, deadlines, and set texts. And they're happy to leave it in the classroom. So this week, we're going to have a look at what an essay is, who it's for, and how you write one. I'll be joined in the studio by Travis Elbra, writer and judge for the Notting Hill Editions Essay Prize, the winner of which was announced last week. And we'll hear from Brian Dillon, who recently mused on his love for essays in a book called Essayism. That's all coming up on Culture as we ask, how do you write an essay? Without further ado, Travis Elbra, here he is. Once again on the Culture Show, welcome back.
A pleasure.
Thank you very much for coming in. Now, you are an essayist, you are a judge on essays. Your palette is very broad, I suppose, in these matters. So, as we said, we're going to play in a bit of tape from Brian Dillon, the author of this wonderful new book called Essayism from Fitzcarraldo Editions. Why don't we try, before we do that, however, just to define what an essay is, because it's not a column, it's not a feature, and it's not novelistic, although it can have sort of flights of fancy in it. Is it possible? Can we try to define what an essay is before we dive?
Well, I mean, some of the argument is that it doesn't have a form, and that is that's its beauty, that it can be whatever you want it to be. I mean, one of the wonders and difficulties of judging this prize was that we all, when we arrived, you know, having read reams of essays and with our choices, our selections from the pile which had come in, everyone seemed quite relaxed about what they thought an essay was until people had to pitch different pieces that they had chosen against one another. And then very suddenly, different arguments and definitions started to come forth. Some people argued it should have some sort of formal argument, should take you somewhere. Others that really it could be something more emotive and strange and mysterious and didn't necessarily have to have a driving argument. So in some respects, Rob, I'm not helping at all because I'm offering more non-definitions of a
non-form. But it's good to know what the elements are that go in the suit.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I think you alluded to that idea of the school essay, you know, which in a way, you know, introduce, make four arguments, destroy three of them, round up with the winning argument. I mean, that certainly is an essay. One of the definitions that someone bandied around was, you know, Paul Klee had this great line about how a drawing is really taking a line for a walk. And an essay could be thought of in a way as taking an idea for a walk or taking a pencil for a walk in a more kind of literary way, as it were. So I think that I quite like that idea that it's spurned by thought and it takes you follow through the writer's impressions of something or their thought processes, and you come up at the end, you know, feeling you've learned something different about something. I mean, one of the shortlisted winners, or one of the pecking order for this prize was, you know, there are six overall winners and one super winner in a sense. But one of them was a piece by a writer called Garrett Kaiser, which was about his weekly shopping in Price Chopper.
Yeah.
And from the surface, that sounds a fairly mediocre premise. And if you were pitching that to a magazine, it'd be like, well, you know, I think we all know about the supermarket shopping at this point in time. Shouldn't we be talking about online deliveries or something else? You know, that would be the magazine argument angle. But instead, through this piece, which is quite light and quite witty, it gradually has these moments of grit when it's really talking about early 21st century American capitalism and shopping and choices and things like that. So within what seems like quite even a superficial topic, the essay, or a good one, can tell you something much broader or more intriguingly and interesting about its topic. And I think some of the other ones, I mean, you know, I didn't know anything about Dasher's, the Russian holiday homes.
Yeah, when I read only the prelim for that one. But I mean, what a wonderful specific idea.
Yeah,
there's
definitely
something that we kind of know, we probably know how to spell it. We kind of think we know what it is.
We've seen it in Dr. Zhivago or something.
We've seen it in Dr. Zhivago. We kind of know that, you know, Gorbachev apparently heard about the fall of communism on BBC radio while in his Dasher.
Yeah.
It's these
things
that we kind of know, where you kind of don't know what they are. Right?
Exactly. I mean, so I think it's more a case of the brilliance of an essay should be, in a way, even if I don't care what the subject is, even if I don't know what the subject is about, there's something about it which makes you read it, and once having read it, feel edified by the experience or changed in some way, even if we're going to be, you know, almost metaphysical about it, which probably not, but probably shouldn't be.
I think we can get metaphysical. We can get let's get meta brackets physical, Travis. I think we will, as promised, we'll play in this chat that we did with Brian Dillon, the author of Essayism. We'll do that, and then maybe we'll think of even more wonderful things to talk about as we try to answer how do you write an essay. So Brian Dillon, as discussed, he's the author of Essayism. It came out last month, and he recently spoke with Monocle's Tom Edwards and Daniel Jacopelli on the Monocle Weekly about the beauty of essay writing.
I'd been writing criticism and books. You know, I write about contemporary art, I write about literature, and I teach writing students at the Royal College of Art. And maybe about 5 years ago, this word started to come up among colleagues and students. People started to think about the essay as a form that they were somehow invested in. And I remembered that maybe 20 years ago, as a student studying literature and philosophy, being a bit kind of frustrated at the kind of academic language that I was writing in, and to some degree really enjoying, and thinking maybe there's something else, and maybe it's something that brings together the literary and philosophical writers that really excite me, people like Susan Sontag and Roland Barthes. And I suddenly realized, well, maybe the essay is having a moment. And of course, as soon as I thought that, I looked around, and indeed, it was having a moment. And I think almost to the point now that it's become a kind of cliche. There have been so many articles written in the past few years in places like The New Yorker and The New York Times about a resurgence of the essay, I think especially the essay in America, less so in this country, which might be an interesting thing to talk about. And so I thought maybe there's a moment to kind of plot my version of the essay. And, it's very much my version. It's a kind of constellation or canon that I think has formed how I think about writing and how I hopefully try to practice it.
Very eloquently, indeed. We'll come on to some of those transatlantic comparisons in a moment, Brian. But what about this thing as essay as form? And I guess, I think quite early in the book, you make the point, or in the essay or whatever we should call it, about, I don't know if it's a paradox or something at the heart of it, which is that an essay is necessarily almost as partial view of something, and yet also it is supposed to get to the very heart of something. Is that paradoxical? Is that what makes essays interesting in your view?
I think it is. I think it is what makes them attractive to me, because I like precision in writing. I like people who are exact. At the same time, I like people who are extravagant and adventurous. And so when I think about somebody, you mentioned Joan Didion in the introduction, when I think about Didion's sentences and the way she pays attention to the political world around her, the cultural world around her, her own mind and body and so on, it's very, very exacting and precise. But at the same time, the form that she does that in can be absolutely strange. She's a very elegant writer, so you notice when she starts to stray. So she'll do something like suddenly put into, you know, one of her early essays in the 1960s, a psychiatrist's report on her own case. You know, she'll botch the form in some way. And so my book, I suppose, is about exactly this, that an essay should be, I think, if one wants to talk in terms of shoulds.
That's fine.
should be something that aspires both to a kind of exactitude and therefore, you know, it's kind of well made. And at the same time, essays can include anything. My book starts with a list, and it's a list a page and a half long, maybe 100 or so items of things that essays can be about. They can be about anything.
Do you think essays have become much more self-indulgent in recent years? I mean, you look online at places like, I don't want to name names, but, you know, Thought Catalog, a website in which, you know, millennials write about their problems. Is that the death of essays as well, or is that actually paradoxically helping the renaissance of the essay because more people are kind of exposed to it?
I should say that I have no problem with narcissism in writers. You know, if narcissists are to be accused...
Some of the very best.
If we're going to accuse writers of being narcissists, that's on a par for me with accusing them of, like, owning pencils and things. You know, it goes with the job to some extent. And so I don't object to the kind of thing you're describing. I mean, there really has been, especially in the last 5 years or so, a real movement of what gets called, especially in American context, the personal essay.
Exactly.
To some degree, all essays are personal. They have a voice, even if that voice doesn't talk about itself. So I have no problem at all with that kind of, like, really radical subjectivity, or what gets called kind of lazily as well, kind of confessional writing. That doesn't mean that I think those are all successful essays or that they stretch the form. And I guess that's, for me, the ideal for me is some kind of combination of this absolutely honest, frank voice that may be telling us things that are absolutely personal, but at the same time has ambitions for the form. Knows, writers who know that just pointing to themselves is really not enough. When Kafka said, you know, a great book is an axe that breaks the frozen sea within us. You know, I agree that sense of like an emotional kind of shattering and opening up is really important. But you sort of want to pause to admire the axe too, right?
Are most of the people who practice the craft of the essay novelists and journalists and nonfiction writers? I mean, are the people who are just purely essayists? Do people go into that career path anymore? I want to be an essayist when I grow up. Or must you find income from other means?
I think that one of the joys of essay writing, one of the joys of essayism, if such a thing exists, is that you have to find income from everything. You know, yeah. It's some of my favorite essayists, and this is not just today, but going back to the 18th and 19th century, were freelancers. You look at somebody like Thomas de Quincey, who's most famous for the first ever great drug memoir, Confessions of an Opium Eater in 1821. He wrote for 40 years. His complete works were into 21 volumes, and he spent his entire career as a desperate freelancer, you know, surfing deadlines. So I think one of the attractions, but also one of the terrible things about being only an essayist, is that you are kind of circling in that the freelancer's trap. But that also means that great essayists who are committed to that as a form have a kind of voracious curiosity about them. You have to be interested in everything.
Yeah, that was Brian Dillon, author of Essayism, which is out now, published by Fitzcarraldo. Travis, a lot of interesting points there on essayism. Let's try and tackle this thing, which I wanted to ask you about before we played that tape in, about the idea of subjective. And they talked about it there, this idea of the kind of super subjectivity.
Yeah.
Presumably subjectivity is great, and we all like to read, you know, if a writer is good, we want to know what they think, and we want to know what their point of view is. When it becomes solipsism, you've got to kind of maybe worry, right? But the subjective, it must be a good thing in essays.
This is a terrible thing to say. It depends on the essay.
Okay.
As Brian quite rightly said, and I think this is very true, is that every essay is autobiographical in the sense that, you know, the writer is amassing their material and presenting it. They may not be present on the stage. Remember Hunter S. Thompson actually criticizing Thomas Wolfe for being too antsy to put himself into the narrative of his essays. And that was a great generation of, you know, the new journalistic writers who forged new ways of describing the world and also using weird bits of punctuation and flicking the form.
Coming back from
in that kind of way.
Beat into New Jersey and Norman Mailer and all this stuff where even with without being in the essay,
the
character of the writing was such that no one else could have written it.
Precisely,
anyway, right?
So I think that sense of subjectivity is always there. But as you say, slip into solipsism. Where it might be a bad thing, in a way, is that if you've deliberately not, you know, if the essay has deliberately not considered anyone else's thoughts about this, you know, if you wrote something entirely from a male perspective at this point in the 21st century, ignoring all of the you know, the transformations of the last 40 years and you know, of, as far as, you know, issues of gender equality and so on, then that would probably be a bad piece because it would look mad. It would look as if, you know, you had not...
Staring down the wrong end of the telescope.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's not to say that it couldn't be an interesting essay or even a good essay, but I'm just saying that I think the subjectivity thing, you know, a good essay balances the two. I mean,
it would make me Richard Littlejohn.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, that might make for an agreeable polemic, and you might even agree with it in that way. And again, you know, this going back to the idea about whether an essay is an argument. And sometimes, you know, one can read an essay which comes completely from a different side of the spectrum, shall we say, from one's own, but you can admire the force of it and the style of it and how it's written. I mean, even someone like Didion, whose writing I admire enormously, I often find quite patrician, quite contemptuous often of the subjects, particularly in some of her 60s stuff, that, you know, it's her having a poke about it, this subculture. It's not from within, it's, you know, it's looking down on it, you know, which, you know, again, perhaps is necessary
if the writing's
at the time.
Good, and also
exactly,
well, if the writing's good, you can be, it's also a part of, I guess, being in on the joke.
And again, that I think Brian's great point about the freelance thing, the hack, having to churn out all these words, but within them there are these amazing gems. I mean, Orwell, for example, you know, an exemplar of the essay, perhaps in the English form, and we've talked a lot about American writers, but, you know, was churning out pieces for The Observer and Tribune at a phenomenal rate. Yet some of those pieces, like The Lion, The Unicorn, and, you know, The Moon Underwater, his piece about the idea of the perfect pub, have stood the test of time and are still worth reading today because they have, you know, glints of genius within them that still speak to us. And I think that's another element of it, isn't it? I mean, even De Quincey, The English Mail Coach, which is about the fashion for young bucks to ride on the top of coaches, when in fact they don't really have to at this point in time. They're doing it as a bravado thing. Still has something, you know, catches that idea of the dandy and you know, and fashion, which I'm sure there are kind of contemporary versions of, you know, whether it be, you know, fixie bicycles or whatever, you know, it actually is a similar, you know, the humanity in a way, that impulse that those pieces capture, I think becomes quite universal.
So we're nailing down, we're hammering some pegs in the tent here of what an essay is, aren't we? Something is definitely going into the ground. I think we're becoming, if not watertight, then at least we can shelter in there in a storm. What about, I wanted to ask you, as I said, about the idea of whimsy in here. Mm. I love the idea of the here's my weekly shopping kind of thing. Should you be kind of hiding your light under a bushel with the idea of whimsy, as in you have a larger, greater argument, or is there a bit of irony about it, or can you really talk about, well, a funny thing happened to me on the way to the bus stop. Can that stand the test of 10,000 words, I wonder?
I should say that, you know, some of the other winners of the Notting Hill Prize are much more serious and kind of more honest. I mean, whimsicality, you know, I think there's an element where with that particular piece, you know, it could easily have gone the Garrison Keillor route, which some people may like, you know, and that might be perfectly fine and it might have its charm. But actually what makes it a good essay is that it has grit as well. And that's what, that balance between those two things. I mean, one of the interesting things actually about some of the submissions that we read and at least two of the winners was the inclusion of pictures within the piece. The main winner, you know, William Max Nelson, his Five Ways of Being a Painting, incorporates all sorts of images within the text.
That was lovely. I thought it was a bit like, you know, reading kind of The Rings of Saturn or something.
Definitely.
It kind of had that kind of element to it. And I thought, it's lovely when you can read a grown-up book with pictures in, isn't it?
Yeah. the essay itself is brilliantly... It's almost like a kind of breadcrumb quality to it, that, you know, little facts and little details and little factual details are kind of doled out very subtly, and it's up for the reader in a way to run with these clues. And as you move through the piece, you know, the whole thing kind of melds together and creates. I wouldn't say it has an argument, but it's a worldview about history and memory. And the main kind of hook of it is Walter Benjamin's sort of condensed childhood thing, Berlin Childhood. That's sort of the backbone. But there's stuff about porcelain and Europe's interaction with China in there. There's stuff about his own family portraits and little fragments of his own history within these other broader fragments. And I think it's an amazing piece of work. And it's not, and that certainly isn't whimsical.
It had actually, that essay, the winning essay of this Notting Hill Prize, that was quite memoirish, actually, as well, I found it to be. And is that, if we're trying to, again, hammer these pegs in our essay tent, Travis, is it okay to be memoirish? Or does that kind of break, it's a formless form, the essay possibly, but does that break one of the walls suddenly, you know?
I don't think so. I mean, I think another one of the winners, as it were, Laura Esther Wolfson's Losing the Nobel is very autobiographical, very memoir piece. I mean, Svetlana Alexeyevna, you know, author of Secondhand Time and Voices from Chernobyl, she was one of her translators, and she had the chance to work with her on those books and didn't. It's an essay about regret or possibilities, as well as a piece about translation. I think memoir is often in some respects actually better in essay form, A, because of the brevity of it, rather than there may be only a small fragment of one's life that is worth writing about that closely. It may not be worthy of a full autobiography. Maybe there's, you know, one particular element of one's life is worthy of deeper consideration. I mean, I particularly like, there's an American writer called Joseph Mitchell, who was a staffer on The New Yorker, and he was on the staff for you know, since the 30s.
Oh, this was this legendary guy who passed away last year.
Yeah, a couple of years ago. Well, actually, about longer than that now, but a biography came out last year.
Oh, right.
That's why
I
got extra attention. But he, yeah, from 1964, he never wrote another piece for the magazine, though he remained on the staff. But he was a master at, I suppose, they're almost semi-fictional portraits of characters of New York. And one of the most famous is he did these two portraits of this character called Joe Gould, who was supposedly collecting this oral history of New York. And these are astonishing confections of people and place. And, you know, some of them are composites, it has to be said, not the Gould one, but some of the other ones have later been shown to have been more fiction, perhaps, than fact. But you get this marvellous portrait of an idea of New York and an idea of New York's bars and trawlermen, you know, street preachers, you know, hucksters, you know, all these extraordinary characters in a way. And I think that's another side of the essay. It can be a portrait of someone else. And actually another one of our finalists, Karen Holmberg, is a piece about the artist John Digby, who wasn't an artist I've heard of as well. So that it's something about his art, but it's also a portrait of the person. I think that's another way that an essay can get. I mean, I think some of the, if you think about some of the great, again, Orwell's very good about writing about things like Donald McGill, the postcard artist. So the essay can be an appreciation of someone else as well as an exploration of an idea or an argument, I think.
I wanted to ask you something about the sort of register and the tense in which an essay is written, because there is something about an essay is something digested. Mm-hmm. There is often the past tense about essays.
Yeah.
So you're not, although you will, you know, say, well, so-and-so wrote this about this subject and so-and-so wrote this about this subject. It is wrote, not is has written, I suppose. There is a funny thing about not quoting other people in terms of reporting, but as in bringing in other elements of writing is what happens, right? So there is something sort of about the past tense to essays as well, right? The considered, the long view and the considered.
Considered view. is the right phrase for it, I think. It's not, for the most part, reportage, although that can be an SAS form. Yeah. Again it's the bagginess of it all. I think, I mean, as Brian said in that piece, that I think in America, partly because the magazine culture is different and perhaps a little richer than in Britain, and, you know, maybe similarly maybe in France, and the space with which people are able to write and the breadth with which they're given to write is different. And I think that's probably why the essay, the concept of the essay gets very confusing, because in some respects it could be a profile, and that could include the interviews, that could still be an essay. I mean, Gay Talese's great piece of you know, proto-new journalism, Frank Sinatra Has a Cold, where he couldn't speak to Frank Sinatra because Frank Sinatra was refusing to speak to him because he had a cold and wanted to save his voice. So instead, it's all done through this sort of third gaze. It's all about, you know, Sinatra's hench people and what Sinatra's up to, because he wasn't allowed access to do that. So in the end, what you get is this extraordinarily, in a way, much more broader picture of the Sinatra phenomenon and his entourage.
But is that an essay or a feature? You see, that's where I get into. That's where I get into. That's why I'm scratching my head again now. I'm taking one of your pegs out.
No, well, yeah, feel free. I mean, I think that's just a wonderful piece of writing.
It's just a good piece of writing.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's not. But I think, you know, there are people like Elizabeth Hardwick, for example, who, you know, wrote some amazing essays, and then some of those essays she then resculpts those into a collection of memoir pieces called Sleepless Nights. So, you know, there are, you know, what often maybe the essay can sometimes be the first go, and then, you know, then other things are refined and refracted after that. But I think, again, I suppose what we want the essay to be is surprising, and I suppose some of those feature ideas and bits of reportage don't really change too much over the generations. And one of the exciting things about the essay, or the scope for it, is that it can shift in the same way that many of our people who submitted and some of the winners incorporated pictures into their pieces. And actually, William Max Nelson, the winner, actually said he wasn't even sure that we would accept the essay with these pictures incorporated into it. And he's actually an academic, so he's used to writing academic-style pieces and essays. And this, for him, was a chance to try something different and you know, and refresh creatively. And I think that's really what the essay should always be striving to do, is to refresh the form or play with the form a bit. And the whole thing of, I mean, one of the people that Brian quotes in the book, just saying that, you know, it is the essay is a game that creates its own rules. And I think the idea of play within the form is what makes it surprising and fun. It can also, of course, go horrendously wrong. I mean, there are some things that we read and you thought, what are you doing? Where has this gone? Hang on, you were making a really interesting point there. And now suddenly we're off, you know, in Tunisia on a boat or something. There's some seagulls. What are they doing here? Whatever. But right. So I think, you know, there are still rules within, you know, rules of sense.
There are rules within the game that makes its own rules.
Yeah, exactly.
But so non-essayist style, just in order to wrap up, let's decide some ground rules so that we can give our listeners something to sort of a bit of take home. People call it take home, don't they?
Yeah.
What's my take home? So it can be whimsical, yes. We're agreed on that. It can definitely, maybe should definitely be subjective.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't have to be fair.
No.
It should persuade.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're agreed on that. It often happens in the past tense. We can't report directly, as in reportage.
Yeah.
But maybe we can sometimes. Should it be expansive or narrow?
Either. I suppose narrowness of focus can lend an essay its pulse, you know, the idea of having a direct spine. But it can be, I mean, well, you know, our winner, William Max Nelson's, is in no way narrow. You know, it floats about over kind of centuries and countries and localities and personalities. So I think you have to feel that you're being immersed into someone's thought processes, you know, that you are being... You know, it's a cliche to say this, but you are being taken somewhere.
Yeah, you're going on a journey, and it can be down.
It can be
to the corner shop, or it can be to Tunisia on a boat.
But we'll avoid the word journey perhaps too much. That's too weighted, really, isn't it?
Okay. Taking a line for a walk, I think Paul Clay had it right.
Exactly. Okay. We're taking an idea for a walk. You know,
it's good stuff. We should recommend the series of essays, in fact, that you judged.
Yes, it's called Five Ways of Being a Painting and Other Essays, the winner of the third Notting Hill Editions Essay Prize.
And it's a pretty handsome, beautifully bound...
It's a very beautiful looking
piece of kit. Travis Elborough, as ever, thank you very much for joining us. Maybe we should push people also in the direction of Being a Writer, which is something you've co-authored, which is out in September as well.
Indeed.
Again, no small thing Travis is tackling.
It's an anthology of writerly bon mots about how to do the craft, which I've co-compiled with the novelist Helen Gordon, and that includes, you know, goes from Samuel Johnson to Hemingway to Murakami,
Samuel Johnson to Samuel L. Jackson.
Yes, exactly. Quite could easily have done. Yeah, if he'd written a
book. If only he'd thought to write one, he'd be in business.
He's not dead yet. There's plenty of time left for him to, you know, get cracking on that.
Come on, Sam. Exactly. Thank you so much indeed, Travis. That brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound. Join us again at the same time next week. For the time being, thanks very much for tuning in.